Some hours after midnight, the typhoon abated so much that through the strenuous exertions of Starbuck and Stubb, one engaged forward and the other aft, the shivered remnants of the jib and fore and main topsails were cut adrift from the spars and went eddying away to leeward like the feathers of an albatross, which sometimes are cast to the winds when that storm-tossed bird is on the wing. Instantly the yards were squared to the lively song of "Ho, the fair wind, ho, ye cheerly men!" The crew singing for joy that so promising an event should so soon have falsified the evil portents preceding it. Next morning the not-yet-subsided sea rolled in long, slow billows of mighty bulk, and striving in the Pequod's gurgling track, pushed her on like giant's palms outspread. Long maintaining an enchanted silence, Ahab stood apart, and every time the teetering ship loweringly pitched down her bowsprit, he turned to eye the bright sun's rays produced ahead, and when she profoundly settled by the stern, he turned behind and saw the sun's rearward place, and how the same yellow rays were blending with his undeviating wake. But suddenly reined back by some counterthought, he hurried toward the helm, huskily demanding how the ship was heading.
"East sou'east, sir," said the frightened steersman. "Thou liest," smiting him with his clenched fist. "Heading east at this hour in the morning, with the sun astern?"
Upon this, every soul was confounded, for the phenomenon just then observed by Ahab had unaccountably escaped everyone else, but its very blinding palpableness must have been the cause. Thrusting his head halfway into the binnacle, Ahab caught one glimpse of the compasses. His uplifted arm slowly fell. For a moment he almost seemed to stagger. Standing behind him, Starbuck looked, and lo, the two compasses pointed east, and the Pequod was as infallibly going west. But ere the first wild alarm could get out abroad among the crew, the old man, with a rigid laugh, exclaimed,
"I have it. It has happened before. Mr. Starbuck, last night's thunder turned our compasses. That's all. Thou hast before now heard of such a thing, I take it?"
"Aye, but never before has it happened to me, sir," said the pale mate gloomily.
Deliberately standing before the binnacle, and eyeing the transpointed compasses, the old man, with a sharp of his extended hand, now took the precise bearing of the sun, and satisfied that the needles were exactly inverted, shouted out his orders for the ship's course to be changed accordingly. The yards were hard up, and once more the Pequod thrust her undaunted bows into the opposing wind, for the supposed fair one had only been juggling her.
"Men," said he, steadily turning upon the crew, "the thunder turned old Ahab's needles, but out of a bit of steel, Ahab can make one of his own that will point as true as any."
Abashed glances of servile wonder were exchanged by the sailors as this was said, and with fascinated eyes they awaited whatever magic might follow. But Starbuck looked away. With a blow from the topmall, Ahab knocked off the steel head of the lance, and then handing to the mate the long iron rod remaining, bade him hold it upright, without its touching the deck. Then, with the maul, after repeatedly smiting the upper end of this iron rod, he placed the blunted needle endwise on top of it, and less strongly hammered that, several times, the mate still holding the rod as before. Then going through some small, strange motions with it, whether indispensable to the magnetizing of the steel, or merely intended to augment the awe of the crew, is uncertain. He called for linen thread, and moving to the binnacle, slipped out the two reverse needles there, and horizontally suspended the sail needle by its middle over one of the compass cards. At first the steel went round and round, quivering and vibrating at either end, but at last it settled to its place, when Ahab, who had been intently watching for this result, stepped frankly back from the binnacle, and pointing his stretched arm toward it, exclaimed,
"Look ye for yourselves. If Ahab be not lord of the level lodestone, the sun is east, and that compass swears it."
One after another they peered in,
for nothing but their own eyes could persuade such ignorance as theirs, and one after another they slunk away. In his fiery eyes of scorn and triumph, you then saw Ahab and all his fatal pride. But the bodings of the crew were destined to receive a most plausible confirmation in the fate of one of their number that morning. At sunrise, this man went from his hammock to the masthead at the fore, and whether it was that he was not yet half waked from his sleep, for sailors sometimes go aloft in a transition state, whether it was thus with the man, there is now no telling. But be that as it may, he had not been long at his perch when a cry was heard, a cry and a rushing, and looking up, they saw a falling phantom in the air, and looking down, a little tossed heap of white bubbles in the blue of the sea. The lifebuoy, a long, slender cask, was dropped from the stern, where it always hung obedient to a cunning spring. But no hand rose to seize it, and the sun, having long beat upon this cask, it had shrunken, so that it had slowly filled, and the parched wood also filled at its every pore. And the studded, iron-bound cask followed the sailor to the bottom, as if to yield him his pillow, though in sooth but a hard one. And thus the first man of the Pequod that mounted the mast to look out for the white whale, on the white whale's own peculiar ground, that man was swallowed up in the deep. But few, perhaps, thought of that at the time. Indeed, in some sort, they were not grieved at this event, at least as a portent, for they regarded it not as a foreshadowing of evil in the future, but as the fulfillment of an evil already presaged. They declared that now they knew the reason of those wild shrieks they had heard the night before. But again the old Manxman said nay. The lost lifebuoy was now to be replaced. Starbuck was directed to see to it. But as no cask of sufficient lightness could be found, and as in the feverish eagerness of what seemed the approaching crisis of the voyage, all hands were impatient of any toil but what was directly connected with its final end, whatever that might prove to be. Therefore they were going to leave the ship's stern unprovided with a buoy, when by certain strange signs and innuendos, Queequeg hinted a hint concerning his coffin.
"A lifebuoy of a coffin?" cried Starbuck, starting. "Rather queer, that, I should say," said Stubb. "It will make a good enough one," said Flask. "The carpenter here can arrange it easily." "Bring it up. There's nothing else for it," said Starbuck after a melancholy pause. "Rig it, carpenter. Do not look at me. The coffin, I mean. Dost thou hear me? Rig it."
"And shall I nail down the lid, sir?" moving his hand as with a hammer.
"Aye.
And shall I caulk the seam, sir?" moving his hand as with a caulking iron.
"Aye.
And shall I then pay over the same with pitch, sir?" moving his hand as with a pitch pot.
"Away, what possesses thee to this? Make a lifebuoy of the coffin, and no more. Mr. Stubb, Mr. Flask, come forward with me."